Hey, listeners of The Right Time, check me out on this episode of the ESPN Daily Podcast. I talk with Mina Kimes and my thoughts about part two of the Michael Vick 30 for 30 documentary. If you like the episode and want to hear more stories from the top reporters and insiders on the planet, you can download or subscribe to ESPN Daily wherever you get your podcasts.
I totally ask for forgiveness and understanding as I move forward to bettering Michael Vick, the person, not the football player. I will redeem myself. I have to.
When Michael Vick was sentenced to prison in 2007 for running an illegal dogfighting operation, it marked a stunning downfall for one of the most gifted football players in a generation. Now, more than 10 years later, Vick's name continues to stoke debate between those who think his crimes were unforgivable and those who think he has earned redemption. Today, we explore those questions and more ahead of the debut of the newest 30 for 30, Vick, part two of which debuts tonight on ESPN. I'm Mina Kimes. It's Thursday, February 6th. This is ESPN Daily, presented by ADT. Hey, Bomani.
How are you?
Bomani Jones is the co-host of High Noon and has covered Michael Vick since his time with the Falcons.
Michael Vick was a captain in the Pro Bowl this year, and there were a lot of people who weren't happy about that. There were some petitions to remove him. One got over 700,000 signatures, and Roger Goodell had to answer questions basically defending the decision.
We have supported Michael in his recognition of the mistake that he made. I know that there are people out there who will never forgive him. He knows that. But I think this is a young man that has really taken his life in a positive direction, and we support that.
Why do you think the name Michael Vick still elicits this sort of reaction from people?
I wonder how much the people who are that bothered, and such is their right? Like, if this is their third rail issue, this is the thing that cannot be crossed over. I don't feel like I'm quite in a position to judge if you decide that this is your thing, right? But in the last 10 years, since he got out of jail, he has probably been, at least at different points, I don't know how much it continues to now, but like the most dedicated animal activist that there had been in the country. He's done everything we ask somebody to do when they make a mistake. And I really wonder if people believe that permanent banishment is the true way to respond to a handful of transgressions that people commit. Because if that's the case, man, we're never going to get anywhere. You got to give people some path toward redemption in order to get people to be accountable for their behavior. And he has been as accountable for his behavior as anybody else.
Part two of the Michael Vick 30 for 30 airs tonight. You're one of the people interviewed for it, and it documents Vick's fall from, you know, being this generational talent to being a prison inmate. And then it gets to the comeback with Philadelphia. For him, that downfall began in 2007 when he was sentenced to 23 months in prison for running what a judge called a cruel and inhumane dogfighting ring and then lying about it.
Is there any other kind, by the way?
Yeah, I guess not, right? That's a good point. Let's go back to 2007, you know, when this news came down. Because you've been covering Vick for a while. You're from Atlanta. You're a Falcons fan. How shocking was this for the sports world?
All right, so let me give you the shakeout for me in all of this. Because I was working at ESPN.com's page two at the time. And you're coming off what I contend to be the worst Vick season. He ran for 1,000 yards, but as a passer, he was awful. I think 31st in the league in yards per attempt. The Falcons as a team were that year with him. And I got a call from a publicist at PETA, whom I knew. And she's telling me, you know, I'd seen these things about, you know, something going on at this house that Michael Vick owns. I'm like, okay, well, let me know, you know, when something comes. PETA was really, really trying hard to push this story and to get it out. Like, hey, man, Michael Vick has been associated with fighting dogs. And maybe it's just because I'm Southern. I don't know. But it did not register with me that this was going to be the scandal that it turned out to be. Man, a week later came and that thing hit the news. And I was like, okay. Whoa, people are very, very offended and bothered by this in a way that I personally simply did not recognize and understand at the time. So like for me, that was the big shock, was that this turned into the national flashpoint discussion that it had.
I think what's so incredible about it in retrospect is this isn't just an average player. It's not even, you know, a low level starter or a, I guess any starter. It's Michael Vick. Like right. He changed the game. And at the time, do you think people are cognizant of this is a game changing player who is being taken out of the game?
I will say, as I didn't stop rooting for the Falcons until after this, because once the quarterback gets caught for dogfighting, why am I even still here? I don't know if it really hit fans in that way until you just look up and it's like, wow, there's one franchise I used to pay attention to that now means nothing. It really was like the Falcons did not exist for the 2007 season.
When did you get the sense that this wasn't just a football story, that this was a mainstream news story?
The encapsulation of when I realized just what was going on and just how big and messy this was going to be. ESPN did a town hall in Atlanta.
And a very pleasant good evening from the city that Michael Vick, well, he once owned, in fact.
And it was a crowd that I think may have been about 50% black and 50% white. And the segregation of Atlanta jumped out.
And if it were a white player who grew up in that and grew up in that environment, we would not be having the same discussion as we are now.
All right, let's check in.
It was very clear that at least for that city, this wasn't just about some dogs. This was about a whole lot more.
How did race inflect the initial response to, you know, the news? Because the news came out in April of 2007. Vick wasn't sentenced until December of that year. So there was a right. long time for this to marinate in public. How was it received?
Yeah, because it didn't really get cracking until like July, I want to say, like right before training camp. I don't think I fully recognized the role race played until that town hall. Like race is out here and it's everywhere. Like, you know, so what role does race play? It's always tricky because I can tell you the role that race plays in literally about every human interaction that people have in this country. And it also becomes tricky because Vick was dead ass wrong. This isn't like the caricature of the O.J. Simpson trial. You know, you didn't have this. Well, the people who think he did it are this side. People who think he didn't do it are this side. No, everybody knew he did it. It became a matter of how important you thought like this thing was. And where race becomes really tricky on this is many black people believe that the loudest advocates for animal rights believe that animals are of greater value than black people are. And the people on the side of animal rights go out of their way to tell you that is not what we think at all. That is not what we think at all. We don't feel that way at all. You have no proof in the world that we feel that way. But you get on the internet right before the Super Bowl this year and you see PETA taking the animals, having them take a knee. And, you know, that kind of stuff makes people look up and be like, you're conflating our struggle with that of animals. And it makes a lot of black people feel like you think animals deserve more respect than we do. One thing I always fought back against is when people tried to make this into a cultural argument. And in the documentary, Vick talks about, you know, how dogfighting was something that he saw around where he was and he didn't give a lot of thought to the morals of it, right?
You know, the feeling of was it right or wrong never really existed. And just being candid because I've seen it so much. And I'm like, I've never seen anyone, you know, be condemned for doing this. And I've seen them doing it in the open.
When people start saying that this was part of his culture, they need to be very clear about what exactly that culture is. Because on them back rows, a lot of white boys out here fighting these dogs, too. Like, it's more of a rural culture. Mm. And, I mean, Newport News, it's very urban, but it ain't a city, if that makes sense, right? So, like, that sort of culture, yeah, you could say that it's going on there. But when people start defending Vick in a very patronizing way and being like, well, that's just what they do. Come on now. I ain't going that far.
How did Michael Vick handle all this during that period, you know, from the news coming out to the sentencing?
Well, I always remember that clip of him going into that party after the charges have come.
Everywhere I go, all around the world, people still support Mike Vick. So regardless of what I go through, people going to love me, man. You know, it's all good.
It's like, people love Mike Vick. And I was like, oh, no, this is bad. But what I will remember is that, I guess, press conference is the way to put it, right after the trial, before he goes to jail. And he's not really reading from notes, though he has them. And he says,
I take full responsibility for my actions. Not for one second will I sit right here and point the finger and try to blame anybody else for my actions or what I've done.
It was maybe the most sincere part of it. It was like, look, I've messed up. I've lost your trust. And I have to get it back. And I think it was in that moment that he realized, like, wait a minute, I'm actually going to go to jail for this.
So Vick went to prison. He lost his endorsements. He filed for bankruptcy. At that point, Did you think there was any chance he'd play in the NFL again?
No, I didn't. Like, I did not expect the NFL to embrace the idea of Michael Vick in the way they have, because this is a league that has never really gotten behind the idea of individual stars. And this one, in this time, and you're still there, it blew my mind.
Coming up, Michael Vick's return to the NFL after prison, and whether certain segments of the population will ever forgive him. So, in July of 2009, Vick is reinstated in the NFL, and then he signed with the Eagles not long after that. There was a lot of backlash at the time. What struck you about that?
I figured that if there was going to be a backlash about Vick coming back to the league, it would have been bigger the second he got out of jail. It would have been keep Michael Vick out of the NFL. What I didn't expect it to be was that he would get to one of those teams and then it would become more localized. And it would just be like, don't put Michael Vick on our team. That was the part that I did not think was coming. I just figured it was good. I was working at the radio station at the time, and we turned over to WIP to hear what was going on there. And man,
I've already gotten a number of text messages from friends all across the country saying, when am I getting invited to the dogfight?
They were not pleased at all with the idea that they had brought Michael Vick on.
I remember going to the Jersey Shore that summer, Bo, and a lot of Eagles fans go on vacation around there and seeing anti-Michael Vick shirts with, you know, dogs on them and such that people are selling at the shore and wearing.
Yeah, see, what's so, like, difficult about that? I think for black people in general, when they look at that sort of stuff is, hey, man, there's so many people that you could be banging on right now that are high profile and have done horrible things to, like, the people and everybody else. And it never rises to the point of wearing T-shirts about.
Yeah.
You know, like, this just became such an easy cause for people to jump on. And I don't think they'd ever really given it much thought as to what exactly it was they were doing. And the work that Vick had done at different points for redemption, they were never going to see it because they weren't looking for it in the first place. I don't even know if they were that invested.
There's a remarkable quote in tonight's episode where former Colts coach Tony Dungy, who became Vick's mentor when he was incarcerated, recalls a conversation he had with Roger Goodell.
But Roger's biggest concern was, hey, I sat across from Michael point blank and asked him questions and he didn't tell me the truth. And so how can I go to bat for him now? And then I'd say, well, you know, we have people in the NFL who have killed people.
Yeah, no, he's like, yeah, you know, if we're going to draw the line somewhere, this is not necessarily where it is going to be. But I think the other thing that the NFL probably knew when it all came down to it is that people ultimately get over it. He started playing well and people made peace.
Bo, why do you think it was the Eagles who were the team that ultimately decided to sign Vick?
All right. So one thing is that Syracuse recruited Vick very hard. And McNabb's senior year, he hosted Vick when he came up and visited. And so McNabb's in Philly. McNabb's like, yo, you know, this. I think that we should pick him up. Andy Reid is in this point in his life where he's been through all those things with his sons getting into the legal trouble and the stuff they were dealing with drugs. And I'd always thought that Andy Reid probably looked at Michael Vick and treated him in the way that he would want someone to treat his sons after the mistakes that his sons had made. And brought him in. Also keeping in mind that Andy Reid has long had this vision of running a college-type offense in the NFL with a mobile quarterback, and I just think he looked at Vick and was like, oh my God, the things that I could do with him.
So once Vick gets back in the NFL in 2009, he's playing behind McNabb. How does he start handling, you know, the rehabilitation side of his job?
Well, one thing he did was all the animal rights work. Right. It was all the talking to kids and explaining to them that dog fighting was wrong and sharing his story and recommending to people that they don't do the things that he did. That was a big part of it. The other thing with Vick is that every time someone brought this up and every time I've seen him talk about this stuff in the last 10 years, he's always handled the question and he's always taken the responsibility upon himself. No matter what happens, start by saying how you messed up and then go from there.
So in 2010, Donovan McNabb gets traded. His replacement, Kevin Cobb, goes down with an injury almost immediately, and Michael Vick takes the reins as the team's starting quarterback. What happens next?
Andy Reid, from what I can tell from that, was just looking for an excuse to make Michael Vick the starter. Because Cobb could have easily come back. Then, you know, whenever he came back, yeah, it was Kevin's job. You don't lose your job to injury. Nope. Michael Vick is the starting quarterback. And he started the whole year. And the Eagles made the playoffs. It was the best season Michael Vick had as a quarterback. The game against Washington was generally the best game he ever played. The first half he played against Washington was maybe the best first half of football I've ever seen anybody play.
Vick taking another shot. Jeremy Macklin pushed off, caught it, touchdown! Oh, man! Never seen anything like this, ever.
It was amazing to consider that after that time away, somehow he came back better than he had been before. Not as explosive, not as exciting, certainly better. He had to work harder in 2010 than he ever had before, and it worked out. Right. Like, I mean, I don't think he had a great season after 2010, but 2010 will always be the crown jewel of his career. That was kind of the culmination of the redemption as football player, not as much as man, but definitely as football player.
But those things are related, right? I mean, the fact that he was redeemed as a football player, as the documentary makes clear, and as you mentioned earlier, played a large role in why so many people were willing to forgive him.
Yeah, well, it's the only reason we cared about what he did in the first place, right? Like, society wouldn't be mad at him if he wasn't a football player in the first place. And in the end, with a lot of these guys, we have to remember, we are here primarily because they are athletes. We are here primarily because of what they do on the field or on the court or whatever it is.
It's been interesting this season with the rise of Lamar Jackson. Obviously, Michael Vick is the player that everyone compares him to, right? And as we've talked about that and Vic's impact on the game, on Jackson's trajectory, it's really just been about football.
Yeah, and it's funny, too, because I still think that Michael Vick as a talent was more talented than Lamar Jackson. I think, as like especially as a thrower, I think that Vick had more raw talent than Lamar Jackson did. But that's like whenever, you know, Mike says Lamar Jackson's better than me, that's very nice of you. But if he is better than you, then explain that the reason is because I wasn't as serious about this as he is.
Having interviewed Michael Vick about Lamar Jackson, I'm not sure he believes that. I actually don't think he does at all.
Yeah, I don't feel like he could be as delusional about some of the other stuff in his performance and then suddenly get all the humility about Lamar Jackson.
So after that year, Vick got, you know, the $100 million contract, and he played intermittently well, but, you know, he got old. And then after Philly, he had a couple of stints with Jets and Steelers before ultimately calling it quits. What's he been up to since he retired?
Well, he's got the job with Fox. So he's doing television now, which, again, is a very interesting thing because television hinges so much on likability. He's got his money, right? He paid everybody back off the bankruptcy. He is comfortable in a way that I think one would not expect from a guy who lost everything in the way that he did. And now, with the help of the NFL, he really is in an interesting space where he'll never be a Hall of Famer, but he'll always be a legend.
Do you think the public at large will ever forgive him?
I think the public at large has forgiven him. I think that if you have not forgiven him at this point, you are probably not going to. We've got the people who just believe that what he did was so awful that no one should be forgiven for it. And I think they probably need to check themselves on the notion of forgiveness, like some introspection about that. But I also think there are the other people who are using the dogfighting as a shield for more insidious reasons that they hate Michael Vick. And I think it's hard to ignore the role of race in this, if for no other reason than looking at all the different people who thought he should have been executed for this. It had no problem stating publicly that they thought he should be executed, or specifically referred to hanging him, which is black people a little different than it does everybody else. And those people are not going to forgive him because you can't be forgiven for being black, because that part's not going to change. But that's not everybody that's got a problem with Vick, but it's damn sure a lot of them.
Working on this documentary, being a part of it, and sort of seeing Vic's story laid out in full, Bomani, did change the way you think about sort of him or how he's viewed in the public imagination at all?
It made me wonder what people will do if they have more information. What people will do if they know more about Michael Vick, and if they know more about what he's done since this happened, if they knew more about what he did before he got there. Are they capable of empathy with him in that way to see this? Because what this story is, it's a story about a man. And I think that for a lot of people, when they talk about Vic, they want to talk about dogs because that's the part that's important to them. This isn't everybody, of course, but for a lot of people, the dogs are the part that's important to them. It will be interesting to see how many people there are who will watch this and then say to themselves, you know, I hadn't thought of it like that.
Thanks so much, Bo. Coming up, why the Mookie Betts trade is one for the record books, and why Boston fans are so, so mad about it. Here's another story I want you to know. As I'm sure you've all heard by now, it's been a rough couple of days for Red Sox fans. And I say that as a fan of the Seattle Mariners, which means no one can ever outsuffer me. But after Boston sent Mookie Betts, their young, transcendent former MVP, to Los Angeles, I did feel a twinge of sympathy for their fans, who have many, many reasons to be upset. They're angry because they root for a team that's openly admitted their priority is to get under the luxury tax and reset their penalties, despite the fact that their owner, John Henry, is a billionaire. They're upset because that billionaire's company, Fenway Sports Group, has grown in value from $700 million to $6.6 billion since he bought it, according to Forbes, and ticket prices at Fenway have gone up. They're mad because while this move is being defended as the team trying to get out ahead of Betts leaving in free agency, the Red Sox could have participated in free agency or offered Betts a contract that actually reflected his market value instead of the lowball one they reportedly made before trading him away. All of which is fair. But what struck me the most about this is how unprecedented it is. According to a piece by The Ringer's Ben Lindbergh, over the last 2 years, Betts has accrued 17.7 wins above replacement. Here's a list of players under 28 years old who have been traded with that kind of recent production. Mookie Betts. That's it. That's the list. If you expand that list to players of all ages, there's only one other guy in the last 80 years who's been traded after being so good, Roger Clemens. Now, as you may recall, Clemens was on the Blue Jays and didn't think they could contend. The Red Sox can and should contend, which is why this is so infuriating for their fans. Just 2 years ago, when they won the World Series here in LA, the Red Sox broke their own franchise record for wins. Now, they're making history again for all the wrong reasons. I'm Mina Kimes, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.